chapter, the killing of another two demons by child Krishna. Especially the mothers, the child had passed. So one of them was a ceremony having to do with when the infant turns on his side and reaches a certain age of infancy. So anyway, it was the occasion of some ceremony, and Mother Yasoda was busy. There were Brahmins there, people to be tended to. So she put the very small infant under a cart. And so, as was seen by some of the children who reported it later, Krishna touched his foot to that cart, and out of all proportion to what he had done, he just touched it with his foot. A whole big cart full of utensils all crashed down with tremendous noise and clattering and havoc. And by doing that, he also killed a demon, Shakatasura, who was like a ghost living in the form of that cart. Prabhupada describes it. Krishna wanted to draw the attention of his mother, but while doing so, he created a great havoc not understandable by ordinary persons. These narrations are wonderfully enjoyable, and those who are fortunate are struck with wonder upon hearing of these extraordinary activities of the Lord. Although the less intelligent regard them as mythological because a dull brain cannot understand them, they are real facts. These narrations are actually so enjoyable and enlightening that Maharaj Parikshit and Sukadeva Goswami took pleasure in them, and other liberated persons following in their footsteps become fully jubilant by hearing about the wonderful activities of the Lord. So, of all the activities, these activities of Krishna are special. They're the most, and they're also the most human-like. So one feature of that pastime is remarked by Vishwanath Chakravarti, was that it was a very effortless thing that Krishna did, just by a touch of his foot. Whereas when he displayed his pastime of cheating Bali Maharaj by expanding himself into the universe in three steps, that was a huge endeavor that he did. Not that it was hard for Krishna, but still, somehow or other, he did a huge endeavor. In fact, he's called Mahakram, Urukram, for doing that tremendous act. And similarly, when he killed Hiranyakashipu, as if he had to become very formidable for such a big demon, he took a very fierce form. But as Krishna, he just remained a little baby and did everything with a soft foot. So this is sort of typical of the Krishna's pastime. The only thing he's doing is enjoying, that's all. And so Prabhupada says, those who are non-envious, those who are devotees, they enjoy Krishna staying as he is and doing wonderful things. Krishna's liberated, and those who take part in his pastimes are liberated. So it's encouraging, because I see from the questions that devotees ask, either for ourselves or for others, that we sometimes have a problem hearing Krishna Katha. In fact, we read, even in the Bhagavatam last night, somebody said that people don't like to hear, I think it was Maharaj Parikshit, said people don't like to hear Krishna Katha. So it's encouraging that there's discussion about the practice of Krishna Katha. Here's one statement. When one develops the practice of hearing Krishna Katha, he is certainly transcendental to material existence, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Sagunan Samati Yaitan Brahmabhuyaya Kopate. Unless one is on the spiritual platform, he cannot enjoy the transcendental activities of Krishna. Or in other words, whoever engages in hearing the transcendental activities of Krishna is not on the material platform, but on the transcendental spiritual platform. Note the word practice here, the practice of hearing Krishna Katha. So we shouldn't sit back and think in a mentally speculative way why we can't hear Krishna Katha, or are we elevated enough to hear it, what's the problem, but start to practice, and we won't be perfect in the beginning, but we certainly won't make any progress if we don't practice some regular hearing. And it really is easy. The topics are arranged so easy. If you just give all, submissive oral reception to hearing about Krishna. Although it's all liberated, activities of the liberated personality of God, for liberated persons, will become like that by hearing. So the children saw this, and then when the parents came around to see what had happened, and they were very astonished that somehow, without any explanation, this whole car had collapsed, and everything was fallen and broken around Krishna, but he was all right. So the children said, this is what happened. It fell because Krishna touched it with his foot. So this seemed very unlikely explanation. Prabhupada says the gopis and gopis look at his childish talk. But that was the report. And the reason that the parents didn't understand it is because of the yoga maya. In a sense, they had no business understanding it. Their business was to protect Krishna from danger. The description of the killing of Shakatasura is very brief. And then it's immediately followed by another demon that happened when Krishna was a year old. It seems like, some of these things, it seems like Mother Yasoda was neglecting the child, that he's left alone and then he gets into some trouble. But I think mostly it's like she's with him every moment. And if she leaves him alone for a moment, immediately the demon moves in. And anyway, Krishna wants it to happen. So he arranges it that his mother leaves him alone for trouble. So one day when he was a year old, she wasn't neglecting, she had him in her arms, and all of a sudden Krishna felt very, very heavy, and she couldn't even hold him anymore. And she even thought, this is something strange is happening. Maybe, again, some bad influence. But still, what could she do? She couldn't hold him anymore. So she put Krishna down. And what Krishna was doing by this, you could call it a yogic siddhi, to become very heavy, is he was indicating that there's a lila coming up with this Trinavarta demon, which had to do with weight changing. So what happened shortly after that was one of these, sometimes called wizards, or this magician, this yogi, the black art yogi, Trinavarta came, and he took the form of a whirlwind and picked Krishna up and flew into the sky. And at the same time, to cover himself and bewilder everybody, he created a big dust storm all over Vrindavan. So nobody could see each other, and they very soon saw that the child was gone. Prabhupada describes, the child was on the lap of Mother Yasoda, who was therefore in possession of everything in the world. But when the child assumed such heaviness, she had to put him down in order to give Trinavarta an opportunity to take him away and play with him for some time before the child returned to the lap of his mother. So once again, Mother Yasoda was not aware that there's nothing to worry about, everything rests in Krishna. But so in the danger, she prayed to God, Narayan, and she called on the Brahmins. Could they do something to counteract the situation? So although Krishna was heavy, then he became very light so that the Trinavarta could carry him for his pleasure. Then it was a duel, like a mystic, a duel between two persons adept in the mystic siddhis, Krishna and Trinavarta. So what Krishna then did, he assumed the perfection of becoming very heavy. And he became so heavy that the demon felt himself being choked and dragged at the neck. So he wanted to get this small object off his neck, this baby, but he couldn't do it. So Krishna was, you'd say, almost like a child, was holding on tight. And at the same time, he was creating great weight and choking and killing. And so Trinavarta was trying to do something to counteract, but he couldn't. And finally, he lost his life and then crashed down to the earth. And all his bones were broken on a slab that he landed on. So we're speaking these things like all the other emotion-filled leelas of Krishna from a sort of distance, although the least distance the better, or we can identify with it. But we can at least try to appreciate that these things weren't taken lightly in Vrindavan. Everyone was very bewildered and upset, but at least relieved, because what always happened was some terrible thing was happened, but somehow or other Krishna was saved. So they felt very blessed that God must be protecting them, and Krishna must be a very innocent child, that although these evil spirits come, he's never killed, but he's always being attacked. So this is the kind of mentality that was created. Not exactly just peaceful, routine kind of life, but always some upsetting situation, but always Krishna being saved. So in this case, everyone was relieved, and just like with Putana, Krishna continued to, he stayed on the chest of that demon and was playing. Chinmaya rasa, enjoying transcendental pleasure. And as far as what I described as the upset mood, that was a transcendental ecstasy also of parental love. So these were two incidents in when Krishna was just a baby. Then an important incident happened, which is called the name-giving ceremony. The priest of Vasudev, Krishna's real father, was inspired by Vasudev to go and perform a reading of the horoscope and give names to the two children of Vasudev, Krishna and Balaram, or at that time they weren't named. So Gaga came and he presented himself. I'm the priestly guide of Vasudev, and I've come to perform this ceremony for the benefit of your sons. And Nanda took the role of the Vaishya and gave all respect and honor to the Brahmin priest that he has come to my home. Although Nanda was a liberated person, he thoroughly played the part of his varna ashram, to be a cowherd man, and therefore to honor as above him the Brahmin. And Garga Muni also played the role of being in a position of superior knowledge. What was it that he knew that Nanda didn't know? He knew Krishna's actual birth in Mathura from Vasudeva and how he was transferred. So it is interesting that Nanda appears naive and innocent, and the other person appears to be in a superior position, whereas actually Nanda is superior because of his love, intense love for Krishna and not knowing anything else. So there was a problem, however, with this name-giving ceremony, because as we described, Kamsa was having this reign of terror, killing young children. So if he heard of the visit by Gargamuni, he might conclude that this child was had some connection with Vasudeva and should be killed. So Gargamuni said this and said, I don't want to be responsible for this if this happens. But Nanda was so anxious to take advantage of his presence that he said, well, just my son, he must have advantage of the name-giving and the purificatory ceremony. Let's just do it in secret. We can do it in the cowshed and no one will know that it took place. So in that way, they did it without having any festival or ceremony where people attended. So he went and performed this ceremony, which included reading a horoscope, saying what the future of the children would be, and giving them names. So the names he gave to the one son, he gave three names, Bala, Rama, and Sankarshan. Does anybody know what those names mean?
Bala means strength. Ram means a place of unique potential. Sankarshan is the transport.
One who holds together all the universes by gravity. And in this case, specifically, that he would unite these two families, the family of Vasudeva and the family of Nanda, because he comes from both families. But he's also Sankarshan, the original Sankarshan in the spiritual world. So then Garga said, your other son, he appears as an incarnation in every millennium in three colors, white, red, and yellow, and now he's blackish. Of course, this became a very important prophetic statement, which is pointed out by the Acharyas later as an indication of Lord Chaitanya's identity also. He should be called Krishna because he's all attractive. And Gargamuni says, actually, his identity is that he's as good as Narayan. Narayan is the name of God as Vishnu, which was why everyone accepted. He said he has a very close connection with the Supreme Lord himself and his own identity. Gargamuni said, for this son of yours, there are many forms and names according to his transcendental qualities and activities. These are known to me, but people in general don't understand them. So Krishna has many different names. Even Gargamuni says he knows, but even things he doesn't know. Because he's called Krishna doesn't mean he's not called other things. According to his different activities, he has many names, but the name Krishna means all attractive. So this was a very nice name that was given to the son of Yasoda, Ananda. Then he says what this son will do as he grows up. He said he will give protection and pleasure to the cows and the Brahmins of Gokula. So this may seem a little odd that if he says in such a such a revelation to hear that it's not an ordinary child, he's as good as God, and yet he seems to have such a local function. What will he do when he grows up? He'll protect the cows and he'll protect the Brahmins. But this is actually Krishna's personal mission. As Prabhupada writes, Krishna's first business is to give all comfort to the cows and the Brahmins. In fact, comfort for the Brahmins is secondary, and comfort for the cows is his first concern. So if this is neglected, it doesn't mean that it's not the desire of Krishna for the earth planet. We're doing everything else which is not pleasing to him. But if these activities, Brahminical culture means take advice from spiritual persons and protect cows. So it is one of his important functions. It doesn't say his important function is economic development or military development and so on. And another way to understand that it's not just a something inappropriate for the Supreme is that protection of Gokula and promotion of Gokula's Brahmins and cows is an infinitely large thing. Gokula is not just a village, it's the spiritual world, and so Krishna is the lord of Gokula or Goloka, and everyone should take part in that world. However, even those things that we would consider more important functions, because with our worldly sense, Krishna also had things to do in that line. According to Garga Muni, he says, as recorded in history about your boy, when there was an irregular, incapable government, Indra having been dethroned and people were being harassed and disturbed by thieves, this child appeared in order to protect the people and enable them to flourish, and he curbed the rogues and thieves.
Yeah.
So Krishna, he acts very much in the world, not only as the cowherd boy. He will subdue the forces of evil, even on a cosmic scale. So all these big things were predicted, and then what was really more closer to home to Nanda was that he said, also, right in your own time, Krishna will defeat his own enemies, and anybody who becomes a friend of him, he'll be protected. All things considered, Garga Muni concludes, this child of yours is as good as Narayan. In his transcendental qualities, opulence, name, fame, and influence, he is exactly like Narayan. You should all raise this child very cautiously and carefully. The word that Garga Muni uses is Narayana Sama, which means equal to or as good as Narayan. But this is a little strange because Narayan, how can he have an equal? God is one, he's supreme, although he has different expansions. So actually it's a little bit equivocal. He's not revealing everything about Krishna. And what he's saying to Nanda is that your worshipable deity, Narayan, is so pleased with you that he has sent you a son almost equal to him in qualifications. Therefore you may designate your son with a similar name, such as Mukunda or Madhusudan. If you can protect this child very cautiously, as Narayan always protects you, the child will be as good as Narayan. In other words, what had to be done here is Nanda's parental mood had to be respected. You can't just be told that actually God has appeared in your family and you should just serve and worship him. But so the Vatsalya Rasa was honored by Garga Muni, but at the same time, by astrological calculation, all the signs, he revealed, if you can sort of read between the lines, that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But this took a lot of wonderful things to happen before Nanda Maharaj ever became very interested in that that aspect of things. And practically no matter what did happen, he couldn't be convinced of it. Garga Muni advised Nanda that he should do his best to protect Krishna because there will be many disturbances. So this again is the duty of the father, even if the son is Narayan or as good as Narayan. Therefore, how fortunate Nanda Maharaj is that he becomes the father of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so that one a Vaishnava poet has written, let others, fearing material existence, worship the Vedas, the Vedic supplementary Puranas, and the Mahabharata. But I shall worship Nanda Maharaj, in whose courtyard the Supreme Brahman is crawling. So when God comes into this world and appears as if a human being, and therefore human being means takes mother and father, that is not a mother and father by karma, but selected by being great devotees. And what kind of great devotees? To be mother and father, but to love him and protect him. This is Nanda and Yasoda. And so they enjoyed the little childlike activities of their son. And we see these in paintings and we hear them in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There was like big things that happened, but then everyday things that happened. Like they used to play in the, just like ordinary boys in Vrindavan or in village life, with the calves. And sometimes they would grab just to stand up, they would pull on the tail of the calf and stand up, and then the calf would get disturbed and run and pull them through the mud. And everyone would come, and the women would come and enjoy and laugh at the little childish activities. And like children, there was naughty behavior of Krishna and Balaram. And this gave them a lot of pleasure also. There's that wonderful pastime where some of the gopis come and complain to Mother Yasoda about Krishna and how he's coming to their homes and stealing the butter from their homes. And this is the essence of the Vatsalya Rasa, which Krishna spread not only to his own parents but all over Vrindavan by going to people's homes. And so then they would get superficially angry and complain to his mother. And but actually they were waiting, is he going to come again and steal the butter? He's called Makanchur, butter thief, for these pastimes. So actually what he was doing was giving them all great transcendental pleasure through these activities. And it was their pleasure also, one form of their pleasure was to go and complain to his mother about it. All the pastimes of Krishna, Prabhupada says, and the great enjoyment exhibited by the mothers are transcendental. Nothing about them is material. They are described in the Brahma Samhita as Ananda Chinmaya Rasa. In the spiritual world there is anxiety, there is crying, and there are other feelings similar to those of the material world. But because the reality of these feelings is in the transcendental world, of which this world is only an imitation, Mother Yasoda and Rohini enjoyed them transcendentally. Sometimes all the gopis would look at Krishna sitting there, his eyes fearful, so that his mother would not chastise. And when they saw Krishna's beautiful face, instead of chastising him, they would simply look upon his face and enjoy transcendental bliss. Mother Yasoda would mildly smile at all this fun, and she would not want to chastise her blessed transcendental child. So, in this mood of Krishna doing something naughty, and his mother being expected to take some action, came this pastime of Krishna eating dirt, which resulted in his showing the universal form. So, it started where one day the children came, and before we read it, the gopis would complain to Mother Yasoda that he comes in our house and he steals the butter. So now the children came and they complained or told on Krishna that Krishna was eating dirt when we were out playing. So there's whether he actually ate dirt is never so clear. It's described that in one place that the complaint was invented, but the verse says, or Prabhupada says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead was playing as a liar and accusing all the other devotees of being liars. But in case we think that Krishna's pure devotees are liars, Prabhupada says, one should not consider these transactions of transcendental service to be untruthful accusations. One should never see such devotees as being ordinary boys speaking lies, for they attain this stage of associating with Krishna by great austerity. So the real point is not exactly to find out who is lying, whether Was Krishna lying or were they lying? But it's typical of childhood activities. It's possible that either one of them were lying and that Krishna was eating dirt. But the real thing is that he wanted to place himself as an innocent child before his mother. She had to decide what to do with him and whether he was telling the truth or they were telling the truth. So to come before his mother, Krishna said, no, they're lying. I haven't eaten dirt. If you think I've eaten dirt, then you can look in my mouth. So he opened his mouth and she looked in and she saw the entire universe, which is described in Krishna book. When Krishna opened his mouth wide by the order of Mother Yasoda, she saw within his mouth all moving and non-moving living entities, outer space in all the directions, along with mountains, islands, oceans, the surface of the earth, the blowing wind, fire, the moon, and the stars. She saw the planetary systems, water, life, air, sky, and the creation by transformation of ahankar. She also saw the senses, the mind, sense perception, and the qualities, goodness, passion, and ignorance. She saw the time allotted for the living entities, the natural instinct and the reactions of karma, and the desires of different varieties of bodies, moving and non-moving. Seeing all these aspects of the cosmic manifestation, along with herself and Vrindavan Dham, she became doubtful and fearful of her son's nature. So this vision of the universal form caused very much conflict for Mother Yasoda between her maternal affection and the fact that she was, like any soul, overwhelmed by awe and reverence and fear to see the greatness of God. The vision made her think that she was mentally deranged. So it appears that these two attitudes couldn't coexist, that either she accepts the universal form, and then, in which case, her being a mother is an illusion. She says this, that actually this is an illusion, that I think I'm the mother of Krishna and that he's my son and Nanda's my father and that we live in this village. This is the kind of realization any jiva would have, is supposed to have. So she was getting that lessons in self-realization, that it's all, my whole being a mother and Krishna and everything, it's just a temporary illusion compared to the vastness of space and time. So it was like destroying her her yogamaya relationship with Krishna. In preaching in the ordinary sense in Krishna consciousness, we inform all people that their family and sons are actually illusion. But if this is so, then Mother Yasoda's rasa with Krishna is also a misconception. So she was thinking like this, and then the yoga maya, or the potency that Krishna uses to bewilder his pure devotees, so that they can think of him as a friend or as a child or as a lover, that came again and became predominant, so that she would not be disturbed. Therefore, Mother Yasoda put aside the philosophical revelation. The Krishna book says, while Mother Yasoda was thinking in this high philosophical way, Lord Krishna again expanded his internal energy just to bewilder her with maternal affection. Immediately, Mother Yasoda forgot all philosophical speculation and accepted Krishna as her own child. She took him on her lap and became overwhelmed with maternal affection. But Mother Yasoda, of course, is praised for being the mother of Krishna, but even when she was seeing the universal form, she was acting as a pure surrendered devotee, and she was ready to renounce her possessions and her position in an exemplary way. But at the same time, Krishna didn't want her to do that. Prabhupada says her attitude was, now let this incident be forgotten. I do not mind. He is my son. Let me kiss him. What Mother Yasoda comprehended during the time she saw the universal form would be considered by most transcendentalists the gift of many, many lifetimes of austerity and meditation, but she didn't want it. The glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are studied through the three Vedas, the Upanishads, the literature of Sankhya Yoga, and other Vaishnava literature. Yet Mother Yasoda considered that Supreme Personality of Godhead, her ordinary child. So she's so great that she's considered above all the realizations of spiritualists as well as materialists. She's above Karmakanda, Gyanakanda, and even Upasanakanda. Upasanakanda means the path of worship of God, like by the deity in the temple. Karmakanda is when you work for material benefit. Gyanakanda, those who cultivate knowledge. And Upasanakanda, worshipping God. So that would seem to include everything, all the highest realizations, but she's beyond that, because she doesn't worship as God or cultivate knowledge, and she's not interested in material position. She's only interested in transcendental love for the personality of Godhead. Because he who everyone worships with so much awe and reverence, or he who people defy in ignorance, he likes to have intimate pastimes with pure devotees of this sort. And so he protects her maternal affection. That chapter ends with Maharaj Parikshit. He becomes very appreciative of all this mercy that Mother Yasoda and Nanda are getting, and he realizes that they're not really the real parents of Krishna. So how come that the real parents, so-called real parents, who were the first parents of Krishna when he was born in Mathura, why didn't they enjoy the pastimes of Krishna as he grew up? Why Mother Yasoda and Nanda? And then he describes the history of them. Formerly there were a husband and wife named Drona and Dara, and they requested Lord Brahma that when Krishna, when the Supreme Personality of God is born in the world, we wish to be his parents. And by this identity of them, this indicates that nobody can become Mother Yasoda or Nanda. It's not that you can become the mother and father of Krishna. You can have a rasa like that, parental rasa assisting them or something, but they're the eternal mother and father. They're not sadhana bhaktas, they're nitya siddhas. So, I have some questions, and we can have some discussion. But let me get some questions from you too that may have been stirred up. Can write on these pads some questions or comments. I have some left over from last night too. All blank pages. The Vatsalya Rasa seems to indicate that God can be worshipped as your son by his childless activities. Is this any indication that a devotee should see his or her own children in that way? Should you see your child that way? Well, that's something. Is that, what about that? Is that a misconception, or should can some of the parents say, what do you think? Your son is called Narayan. He is as good as Narayan. Narayan Sama. I think it's kind of obvious that our son and daughter is not God. So then, I guess the further question would be, what is the right God-conscious attitude of love for your children? Mother Devahuti, you want to answer that? What's a good God-conscious attitude towards your children? Not to think that they are God.
You should see them as part and parcel of the Lord, and see Krishna in their heart, and serve them like you would a devotee. See them as devotees and the spirit soul.
And then, how do you deal with them?
Well, you take the role of the parent, but you,
Yes. Actually, Mother Yasoda, she didn't see her son as God. That's the whole point we're making. So, like she did, we should also protect her children, and raise them up, in a pious way, to be devotees of God. So, in that sense, she's exemplary. But the thing to avoid is the too much attachment to children, thinking of them just in terms of their bodies, that their body is the self, and that all you want to give in the name of love is material direction, a material good, material career. But the real thing is that you should take responsibility for the child, for their liberation through spiritual upbringing. Since Krishna revealed his position by showing his transcendental form and then causing his mother to forget, should we conclude that this display of his opulences was for the benefit of us, to convince us of Krishna's supremacy, or to show how love for Krishna is ultimately the most important feature of bhakti yoga beyond mere knowledge of his greatness? Yes, I think that's more like in the form of a comment. I think that's the instructional value of it, that we can see the greatness of the pure devotee and how Krishna likes to deal with her, that even greater than the greatness of God is the greatness of personal loving dealings with God. Mm. Even in religion, even in world religion, there's not much concept that you can have such a personal loving relationship with Krishna in these intense human relationships that we have. A mother loving her child, a child loving the mother back. And then, even more than that, is man, woman, lover, beloved, or conjugal love. And that also, that every ordinary reader of Srimad Bhagavatam is given complete inside information regarding how Nanda and Yasoda don't know who Lord Krishna is. It seems that the ordinary reader is in possession of more wisdom than any of the participants in the narrations. Is it a fact that the reader is the most advanced in knowledge by virtue of hearing from Shukadeva Goswami? What to make of this? That's good. Any other comments? I added to that, one doesn't automatically know more than all the pure devotees in the Bhagavatam just by hearing the Bhagavatam. We may be told that the residents of Vrindavan were afraid of the Kali, in the Kali episode, the snake caught Krishna, and we hear that all the residents of Vrindavan were very much afraid. So when we hear it, we're not afraid, because we know that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. So, but it's all theoretical, or it's unfelt, until it's revealed in our hearts. So the point you made is that we can aspire to it, or the opportunity is there. We can enter the Leela if we hear with faith. So the real thing is, it depends on your capacity. It's not like reading an ordinary novel. The whole thing is fantasy anyway, but you know something the characters don't, because you're the omniscient so-called omniscient narrator is telling you what's happening. But it's not a reality anyway. But in this case, it's the absolute truth, and we are being told everything. We are being told the highest realizations, but it's theoretical to us. But the opportunity is there, that just by hearing, you could become a self-realized soul. You couldn't become God, or you couldn't become greater than these great devotees, but you could begin to realize these relative values, that it's better to be a pure devotee than to be a yogi, and things like that. So we should be careful about that and not read in such a lax way that we think that we know better than the Nanda and Yasoda, because Sukadeva is telling us what's actually happening.
Yes. I think also in that it's to appreciate Krishna's greatness too, how King Kunshishin comments how wonderful it is that Krishna, he's playing like an ordinary human being, but he's also, you know, the Supreme Personality of God, and so we can, by, you know, having that knowledge, then we can appreciate kind of the, you know, how Krishna, he's the Supreme Lord, but he's playing like that. So that helps our appreciation.
Mm-hmm. It's not the ultimate reality?
It is.
It is. Yeah. That he's pleasing Mother Yasoda.
Yeah, that he's Yashoda Nanda. They don't see him as God.
Right.
They just see him as the son of Yashoda.
Yeah.
But that is the ultimate reality.
Yeah.
We may want to see him as Vishnu or Supreme Controller. Yashoda Nanda is actually the higher reality.
Right. Yeah.
That's why we have to hold on to something.
Yeah, we were discussing that.
Yeah.
The approaching Krishna. So even if it's theoretical, like Prabhupada says, the Bhagavad Gita, theoretically you should appreciate that the speaker is the Supreme Godhead. If you don't understand that, you misunderstand the whole intent of the book. So even if it's only theoretical, we can appreciate and then try to gain realization of the different categories of knowledge, such as that the Absolute Truth is a person, but the highest feature of his personality is his intimate dealings rather than his awe and majesty. So that's theory and then practice and realization. Theory has to be there, it has to be correct. Here's a question. This person asked the question twice and we didn't pick it up. Should we aspire to have the intimate relationship that the Vrindavan devotees have with Krishna, or to be happy with awe and reverent mood like Devaki and Vasudev? Anyone want to answer that? Usually Prabhupada says that we should be patient to prosecute our duties, which are usually in the mood of awe and reverence, like the deity worship to God, to the deity, bowing down, saying prayers, worshiping in different ways, not dealing with as a familiar equal or something. But at the same time, by hearing of Krishna, we should also become attracted to that kind of relationship. But you can't barge in on it by perfecting your service to the spiritual master and approaching Krishna in awe and reverence. Then he can eventually bring you to perfection. It's a delicate balance that when we hear these things, we can't immediately think, well, yes, I'm going to behave like that with Krishna now. I'm going to be real intimate with Krishna. But you can't qualify for that. If you barge ahead, that's called prakriti sahajya, taking it cheaply. But at the same time, that is our line. That is Lord Chaitanya's line of service. So we can hear about it and gradually become beg Krishna to give us some of that. It takes the form of spontaneous feeling. So whenever we're acting spontaneously, that's good. If always God, worship to God is routine because he's all-powerful and we're afraid of him and it's what you're supposed to do, or you're afraid of being punished, that's all on the lower level. And as soon as it's spontaneous, then you start approaching these other things. Here's a kind of funny question. One hears quite a bit about the women, boys and gopis in Goloka, but not a great deal about the men. Were they mostly cowherdsmen, or were there other occupations, and what were their relationships to Krishna as a boy? I don't think that we don't hear about the men, although we certainly hear a lot about the mothers when Krishna is very small. I can think of a number of occasions where the men are men. They seem to be like a bit in the background, managing things. They decide that it's very dangerous for Krishna and that they should move to Vrindavan. Upananda makes a speech, and they're real men. They're protecting the whole community. They're doing the serious work, and sometimes, especially Nanda, we hear of not. Krishna spends a lot of time with his father. He tries to tell his father to stop the Indra Yajna, and his father's there almost as much as his mother. But Krishna is very attractive to women, so there's a lot of that. Krishna's dealing with mothers and with girls and with boys. Maybe it's a little reflection even of just the human situation, that as a very little child, he's not going to be with the men. And then when he grew up, he's still not with the men. He's off with the boys. So we only see him in his youth. Yeah. How does that come up with this? Yeah, well, that's an example of that the men are kind of foolish. The men are the ones who, the wives of the Brahmins, they want to go to see Krishna, and the men come forward and say, don't go see Krishna. And the gopis want to see Krishna, and the men say, don't go see Krishna. But there's other men also who, especially the fathers, in the fatherly role, they're all very wonderful and simple. Always wondering about Krishna. He must be some kind of demigod or something, and we have to take care of him. So it's they're very nice. If an aspiring devotee comes to realize his or her eternal rasa by the purifying practice of sadhana bhakti, how do the demons in Krishna's pastimes get the opportunity to fight with him? This is like other questions. I guess so many of these themes, they'll be the same questions. If an aspiring devotee comes to realize his or her eternal rasa by the purifying practice of sadhana bhakti, how do the demons in Krishna's pastimes get the opportunity to fight with him? We know the history of Jai and Vijay, but what about the others? Are they also performing pastimes due to similar circumstances? Well, that reminds me, we were playing that game where we were doing that study of Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentioned the each demon represents a kind of anartha that we should drive out of our hearts. I wanted to look at Shakatasura represented in Trinavarta. We'll try to do that. But what about this question? How do the demons get to fight with Krishna? I don't know the identity of every demon in terms of who they were spiritually, but they're all blessed in one way or another. The Jayan Vijay, they're actually from Vaikuntha because Krishna wanted to fight like a sport, so they came to fight with him. But all these others, either they've gotten some kind of curse, like Narada cursed, and the curse is a blessing, or somehow they were chosen as kind of devotees to reciprocate with Krishna in this way. And incidentally, in Goloka Vrindavan, they're not there, they're not present. There's talk about demons, but they're not actually there. There are millions of people who worship Bala Krishna as the highest and most relishable form of Krishna. In one sense, it is easier to relate to these pastimes without misunderstanding than the Rasa Lila. But yet the Gaudiya Vaishnavas aspire to the Rasa Leela, the Gaudiya Madhurya Leela. Should we go with our heart or aspire for higher understanding? Well, we should go with our heart in the sense that we shouldn't resist any warm feelings we have towards any aspect of Krishna. If you hear Krishna as a child, you shouldn't think, well, no, we're Lord Chaitanya followers, we just worship Radha Krishna. It's the same Krishna. And when you hear about Krishna's amorous pastimes with the gopis, you shouldn't, if you feel inclined to it, you should go with that too. But we're not in a position to start talking with these first indications of being attracted that I think this is my eternal relationship with Krishna. We should try to be encouraged by all of it. Love Krishna as a child, as a lover, and then when he leaves Vrindavan as a Kshatriya king, and all of that, the more the better. But the Madhurya Rasa has got all the nectar of all the others is included in that, and plus more. So that analysis is a valid analysis. So if you say it, if you find it easy to relate to these pastimes, then that's what they're for, and we should do it. The nice thing is to hear all the pastimes, and then when we hear Krishna grows up and he's with the gopis, then we should hear that also. It's all Krishna and all the different aspects of his activities, including the universal form. I think we're at the stage where we should just try to relish as much as possible and not exclude anything and start to know a little bit about this inconceivable personality of Godhead and all the different things he does. And then more can come later, like specialization. Specialization, as in just like in a university, first you study generally, then you specialize. But in this course of study, specialization is for very advanced souls. Because you have to be completely purified of material desire before you can talk of that. If we're talking in terms of that when I become liberated and I don't have to come back into this material world because my love of God is so complete and pure, I understand that I'm going to be with Krishna in this particular relationship where Krishna is a child and I'm going to be his parent. That's complete understanding of your spiritual position. But if you're still thinking somewhere in your heart that what I really want is material position, or I want sense gratification, then where's the talk of your eternal position in the kingdom of God? Then we have to go on hearing all the pastimes of Krishna and getting out the anartas, using up our time. I don't know if we'll have time for these demon things. Maybe we can do it another time because it's a little peripheral to the main study. Is anybody interested? Okay, I'll just read it off for those who are interested. And if you don't know what we're talking about, you have to keep coming to the classes. The killing Shakatasura, the cart demon, represents the smashing of old and new bad habits, lethargy, and vanity. I was saying it's hard to understand these, but that one's a little more understandable. This says Krishna kicked him and smashed him. We should think, I want to smash my anarthas. Take that attitude toward it. Krishna, please help me to smash my bad habits. I have all these bad habits. I sleep too much, I eat too much, or I offend devotees. Just smash it. And now I'm getting some new bad habits. So that's that demon. Then Trinavarta represents the destruction of the pride of scholarship. Learning, false arguments, dry reasoning and logic, and the company of such persons who indulge in these things in which demoniac opinions are put forward. You have to figure that out. Why the demon who took the shape of a whirlwind represents all this pride and scholarship? Somebody can write me a nice note. Should you go down? Yeah, like the speculation, ascending process. And also, If you're a debater, you like to cover everybody with dust.
Hot air.
Hot air. Anyway, those are the Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that while the demons are not allegorical, they can be studied to show us different demoniac traits that we have within ourselves. And he gives the specifics. All right. Yes?
I have an idea about that one. That if somebody has a problem with anger, everybody's trying to huff and puff and blow everybody down. So
yeah.
So they get mad.
Yeah, and terrorize everybody by your potency.